floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senors and senoritas. What's happening? This is Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. I've been running all over the place, man. Let me tell you about it. I was out at Americana Fest a couple weeks ago, then back home for a few days, then I turned around and went back out to Louisville and Nashville for a couple of Foo Fighter gigs. Got to hang out with my good buddy Adam Kurtz, pedal steel aficionado, over there at Pilgrimage, and I actually managed to squeeze in another Walk on the Floor interview. I got a lot of them in the can. When I was just in Nashville, I interviewed Nashville legend Tony Brown. Coming soon. If you don't know who Tony Brown is, Google him. From gospel to playing with Elvis to playing with Emmylou Harris to being a producer and A&R guy running a label. I mean, this guy's had his fingers in everything for a long time out there, man. I think he's been in Nashville since late 60s, and it's a great, super long, crazy long conversation that we had. I think it's like a two-hour interview. I might have to break that up into two parts. We'll see. I don't know if you can handle it, people. All right, now tomorrow, I'm leaving again back out there in the world, heading down to Rio. And I'll be back in about a week and a half, going to Bogota, going to Costa Rica. It's going to be a fun trip. And, oh yeah, before I forget, there's a low ticket alert for my late night ACL gig down there in Austin at the Continental with the Cordovas and Leon III. Not many tickets left, not a huge room, so get your tickets today and let's sell that thing out, people. Come on. Okay, now I want to talk to you about my good friends over there at Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds has three warehouses strategically located across the United States to get you your gear faster than anyone else? And that over 90% of Zounds orders arrive within 2 days or less? And did you know that you get free shipping on every order? I bet you didn't know that. So get on over to Zounds.com and get your gear today. All right, let's get on over to today's interview. All right, so a week or so ago, while I was out there at Americana Fest in Nashville, Tennessee, I was lucky enough to get together with Yola for this live taping in front of a real crowd at the Westin Nashville around noon on the Friday. She had a huge buzz on her this year and you know, was one of those artists that like everybody was talking about and it was like, oh, you got to go see Yola. So I'm sure her schedule was nuts. Mine was nuts, but I'm sure hers was probably like 10 times nuttier than mine. So big thanks to Yola and all her people and everybody at Americana Fest for helping to make this happen because it was great. As a black woman from England, Yola definitely sticks out a bit in the white bread world of Americana music. We talked about that. We talked a lot about the glass ceiling of the white brotocracy that she endured coming up in her hometown over there in Bristol, England. She's a self-professed nerd who's had a very interesting life and career, so make sure to check out her latest record, Walk Through Fire, the title of which was inspired by literally catching on fire when her flat burned down. And it was produced and co-written by Dan Auerbach from Black Keys. And he also put it out through his label, Easy Eye Sound. He's always producing and writing and putting out cool music, so definitely check this one out. I wound up having way too many questions and not enough time, so hopefully we'll do it again sometime down the line. But for now, this is Yola on Walking the Floor. Hello, Nashville. How is everybody doing today? How's Americana Fest? I know we're getting into the long end of the week where those late night cervezas and bad dietary choices are beginning to catch up with everybody. But I'm going to tell you what I told the crowd yesterday. We need you to be nice and rowdy because we don't always do these live walking the floor podcast tapings. And we just need to forget that we're in a well-lit hotel ballroom right now, so just take your mind somewhere else. It's 3 in the morning in a smoke-filled bar, and we're gonna get kooky here. All right, so
I have a podcast called Walking the Floor. My name is Chris Shiflett. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for coming down. Give a nice, warm Nashville welcome for my guest today, Yola, all the way from Bristol. How you doing? All right. I see you got your coffee tech, bringing your coffee out, yes. Ready to go.
It's English breakfast tea.
Nice.
You can't take the girl out of England, you know?
Of course not.
Well, you can, but you can't take it out of the girl.
Well, you've been out of England a lot this year, right?
Oh, my God, have I, yes.
You've been touring a lot over here, haven't you?
Yeah, I put together the amount of time that I'm spending here, just on and off since January, and I was like, isn't this about 6 months? So I think I live here.
Yeah. Welcome to America.
Hey!
touring the States is, for anybody that's ever toured out there knows that touring the States and touring the UK are very different logistical animals. So how do you like our 17-hour drives between shows? Like, have you tried to kill your booking agent yet?
I haven't tried to kill them yet, you know. That would really invalidate my visa.
Yeah.
Murder. So I'm trying to stay away from the murder, but I definitely have had a foot down on the kind of morning's functionality of my voice. Yeah. Kind of situation.
Yeah, there's not a lot of thought on the other side of things put into like, well, she played a gig till 2 in the morning last night. Let's get her into a radio station at 7 a.m. to do a song and be really bubbly.
Yeah, and super enthusiastic.
Oh, and by the way, it's 10 hours away.
Oh, yeah.
No
so
problem.
Like, oh, wow. Yeah. So I need some form of time traveling device.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we don't get that.
No, we're over that now. Did
your latest record, like, did it just kind of blow up right away? It feels like, you know, anytime there's an artist that seems to sort of jump on the scene out of nowhere, there's always a big backstory.
Exactly.
You've got a backstory. But did this new record kind of blow up right away? And if so, why this one?
I think this one because it's my first full-length album. I'm debuting. Right. So that I put out an EP before that. I basically learned to play the guitar through writing the EP.
Really?
Yeah. And then I just thought immediately, well, now I'm kind of playing this thing.
Yeah.
Let's just put the first songs that came out of my head on down to, you know, CD and just have something physical to engage with, to talk about. Mm. And so I wrote that EP, I produced and mixed it, and then with a wonderful guy from a studio in West London. Mm. And then, I just kind of took that around, and that was almost like my calling card.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And so I came here 16 and 17. 16, I had like early pressings of it.
Yeah.
And then 17, I actually kind of had it kind of thing. And so that's kind of what I was doing. I was kind of trying to build up from taking a bit of a hiatus for music for a few years. I was kind of in a band previous to that.
Sure. Phantom Limb, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was the main top liner, but I found myself kind of quite ambiguously guiding the chord structures because I'd be like, well, the song's kind of going like this,
right.
So I kind of need the chords to go in this direction.
Yeah.
And so without writing the chords, I was guiding the chords, and I was like, I'm kind of doing the job.
And you didn't play guitar at that point?
No.
Did you play piano or anything?
Nothing. It
really?
Was all just top lines, lyrics, melody.
Well, you,
and I was the only one that did lyrics and melody.
Can
in
you explain
the band.
Like to people that don't know what a top liner is? What is that?
Yeah, so it's a job. It's a, by and large, collaborative job.
Right.
And you're essentially the person they call in to do the Bernie Taupin job. Or like, someone's sent you, if you're in pop, you might get sent a backing track, and then they want you to respond to that backing track. And you'll then put the lyrics and the melody over that backing track. What you can do sometimes is you can go back to the producer and go, I'm the writer-producer, if that's electronic, I need to restructure this for this or for whatever reason. Or sometimes they'll respond by restructuring.
Right.
So I spent my time first, I suppose as a kid, I went through jazz and then into the kind of pop EDM crossover circuit, because it dawned on me very few people kind of classically studied in that area. And so I'd kind of done a bit of opera training. I'd done just endless. I've been writing like right out of the, pretty much from toddling, I'd always been writing. I'd been releasing from about 16. And so I had kind of, that's kind of where I wanted to go. And so I put myself in that environment and started releasing quite quickly. And I, that's kind of what went alongside the kind of Phantom Limb thing, because it made no money. It absorbed so much money, but it created nothing. It was like a vacuum for anything.
That sounds like my solo career. Yeah. Jesus.
For anything, and an absolute absence of business sense. And I was in an environment that was very like, oh, you know, if you're a lady, you couldn't possibly have any solutions. And so, and I was like, you know, 8 to 10 years, a lot of people's junior. And so that was like, I had juniorness, I had ladiness, I have person of colorness, and none of them were really kind of playing in my favor. And so
I read a quote of yours.
The slow nod of knowing. I'm seeing that.
Well, I read a quote of yours that made me think about my own musical upbringing. I think you were referring to your time growing up in the music scene in Bristol. You referred to it as a white bro-a-thon.
Yes.
And like where I grew up in a, I mean, I don't know what Bristol's like. I've been there a couple
it's
times
really
on tour.
It's really mixed in.
Right, yeah. And like I grew
There's
up
no
in, on the West
it.
Coast in a mid-sized city with a college and a lot of hippies and progressive people.
Yeah, right.
And, but there were no young ladies in our music scene at all, you know?
Right.
At all. It was, as you stated, a white bro-a-thon. Like, what is that? You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
it's the brotocracy is real,
right?
You know?
Right, yeah.
It's, and I think people don't, cognitive bias is the B word, you know?
Right.
You don't know that you're constantly filtering out people.
Sure.
It's just that every time you're looking, you're thinking, oh, I need the most capable person I know. It just so happens to be a white guy. And there happen to be a lot of white guys in the west of the world that we live. So, yeah. Like, you know, you're going to bump into a lot of white guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to happen. Like,
yeah, especially
you've got to find a way to navigate the proliferation of white guys.
And alt country or Americana. And
yeah.
These are like, you know, kind of white male dominated genres.
It's everywhere.
Right.
And so, like, you just have to learn to navigate the environment. Like, there are obviously as many women, and for some reason, they're not around, but they're becoming. This year, I've definitely noticed, certainly at this festival.
Right.
I think, can I say this? I'm going to say it. I think the award show was better off for the lady heaviness. I mean, musically, creatively, like, more entertaining. Can I just say that? Yeah. I was more entertained. I gave more of a crap about the music.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm a pretty brutal judge at school. And I'll be like, nah, sorry. I don't care how big the person is. Not today. Not today.
Right.
But I was like, legitimate. Oh, legitimate. And that just kept happening.
Like, who are some of the artists you're thinking about?
Brandy's pretty legitimate. Right?
Yeah, I'd say so.
And I've got to say it, Black Myself, that song, Amethyst, Native Daughters, but Amethyst's voice is just, it's the real, that's from Out of Time. That does not just happen. I don't know what spaceship she came out of, but like, that doesn't just happen, that voice. That's being a student as much as it is just the genes playing a wonderful role and coming out and being just a fierce nerd, which she is, you know.
Did you have the experience, like, when you were first playing music with people and, you know, when you were younger? You know, and I say this, I apologize for my obvious ignorance here, but, you know, like, we're talking about, I'm a white man, so I'm not going to have ever the perspective of what it's like to be a woman coming up in rock and roll and music or whatever, right? So did you have the experience of somebody going like, no, you can't play guitar?
Yes.
That's not for you. Don't do that. No, fuck that. You can't do that.
You nailed it. I did. And my co-writer at the...
How'd the rest of that writing session go?
You couldn't have made it up, could you? It was perfect, yeah. No, because I've explained the job of top lining now, so you know the bit I'm not doing. So that's the bit I shouldn't do, right? Mm. If I do that, well, I'm doing all of it, then it's all over. So it's like, no, you need me. No, you don't have the inclination. You shouldn't. And every time we touch it, like, bursting out and laughing. You can't do that. Just making sure that I stay in my little box.
And, like, how did you...
And I stay in... Well, I was in my
20s. You don't seem like somebody that's going to back down
Not
from that.
Not now,
like, how
because
did you respond to
30s.
That?
20s? Can we just all say what the 20s are? Everyone that's out of them now is laughing. Yeah.
I think looking around this room, we're all long out of them.
They're just laughing and laughing. I'm sorry. I know you two, and I know that you're not out of them yet. I'm so sorry.
You'll be wise like us someday. Yeah. Don't you worry.
You'll learn the hard way, guys. Because you're a doormat in your 20s. And you think you're a real badass, right? And you're not. You're a stone cold doormat. That's what you are. And your standards are for...
Oh, you can swear. This is the internet. You can say whatever.
Because Brits have dirty mouths. We're like terrified of guns, but we love swear words. you're basically, your standards are for shit, you know? Yeah. You've got no kind of, like, your boundaries are rubbish. And so you just allow this kind of rhetoric and you learn what's wrong. Because, like, any kind of, like, abuse or any kind of control, any kind of coercive activity is always insidious. It's never, like, obvious. It's never got a sign, I'm being evil.
Right.
Like, that just, like, that's Machiavellian activity is persuasive. It can be reasoned, at least from one highly misogynistic angle. I was in an environment, everything was tailored to keep me in my box. It wasn't just me, it was my company. Right. If there was someone who had the wrong kind of thought patterns, they weren't cool and they weren't in there. So absolutely everything, the environment was tailored to serve the purpose.
Well, there's also that thing when you're young and coming up where you don't want to blow an opportunity and you maybe keep your mouth shut over some things that you shouldn't and all that sort of, it's going to be my big break and I'm going to fuck it all up.
I just didn't realize. I didn't have a good enough benchmark of humanity to start with. You know, I didn't have any, the standards weren't set high enough for me to know what was going wrong. If you don't have that solid home life, you don't have some good role models that go, oh, by the way, this is massively immoral, then you don't have like the thing to compare it to. You don't have, oh, well, I grew up thinking this. And so I was basically, you get a lot of this in music, people that are connected to music for cathartic reasons, or like they have some pain, some hurt, they have something. Every time someone's a good songwriter, I ask them, what happened? Mm. I'm like, life couldn't have been easy. What happened? These songs are good. Yeah. Which means, something.
You got to not only have the thing that happened, but you have to actually be willing to dive into it.
Yes, you know? Exactly. And so that kind of openness can lead to a vampiric kind of a, like friendship group, people that are very attracted to that and recognize maybe that some of those boundaries aren't quite in place yet. And if you're in the 20s, which is the whole time of not having boundaries, then that's just a double whammy. And so that's pretty much how I put this service on. So I've always kind of had this badass service. And also being a black woman doesn't help, because everyone assumes that because you're a black woman that you are more impervious to harm than if you were. I was exactly the same personality in a tiny blonde casing. You know, I'd say the same things, I'd have the same attitude, and it would all be perceived differently, right? Specifically because I'm a dark skinned black woman as well. Colorism's a thing as well. If I was lighter skinned, that would be slightly different again. Everything kind of certainly in my situation was angled, and because of that assumption you get even more neglect, because people are like, oh, you'll be fine. So you get all of that stuff, and then you'll get the you'll be fine. So then that compounds. And if you have any complaint, then it's because you're crazy.
Right, right.
Or you're angry. And angry is a very black woman thing.
Right,
and
right.
So you can't
coded
talk
language.
Anything about what's going on.
Right.
Because then you're transitioning into angry. And if you go too far into angry, then that's how you get to crazy. And so
that's one step away from crazy.
Yeah, that's all it is. That you
and
have
it
known
doesn't like crazy.
No, and yeah. It does not. And there's still obviously even the term crazy, like we're starting to talk about mental health and stuff, and
yeah, yeah.
Like we ain't dealing with that stuff yet anyway, even if you were being that, which you're not. So yeah, so that's the very long answer to your
right.
question.
What's
but how did you deal with that? I dealt with it very badly by just swallowing it all until it went into all my muscles, and I got vocal nodules.
Really?
Yeah.
And it expressed itself physically.
Though. Yes. As stress
was,
does.
This was not only as working as a top liner, but that this is also in Phantom Limb.
Yeah, or just like the process, the entirety of that environment of being young and of color in music, and you know, being a real nerd as well.
Mm.
Like it was very hard to kind of, people always surprised that you were a nerd, and like I have nerd tastes. Like I love Star Trek and I love Harry Potter and I love, like I read a lot of, like I was always like a Stephen King book or something, and like, you know, like I always had the kind of, I watch almost exclusively sci-fi.
Mm.
and so like it was always like I was always searching for people that were just adjacent to being cool. You know?
That's our scoop for today. Yola
yeah.
is a nerd.
Yes!
Okay, so was there a point in all that? Like, was there one lightning bolt moment where you said, fuck these guys, I'm going solo.
Right?
Was it the nodes? Was that the moment?
Yeah,
for you that you were,
well,
like,
weirdly enough, no, because, like, you're also encouraged to be forgiving and to
right.
get over things, and
right.
which these are all virtues, of course, but
yeah.
you know, so
it's a fine
20
line between forgiving and being,
and
locked
being
on,
exactly,
right?
exactly, and that's the one what you learn.
Right.
So that I had nodules, I was touring straight out of high school, on and off, like kind of the great show, Living on the Street. Another great show, Job Seeker's Allowance.
Mm.
Woohoo! Nodules.
Yeah.
And
feast or famine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think about 23, I got nodules. And then I couldn't speak for 2 months, and I couldn't sing for a year and a half.
Jesus.
And so I was in a band called Bugs in the Attic, another band called the Cuban Brothers. And I did all sorts of other things in the kind of neo-soul kind of
right.
scene. And I dropped all of those jobs, and I managed through serious negotiation to get what we used to have in the UK called incapacity benefit.
Ah.
And it was for people that were long-term injured that couldn't do their job.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm going to explain everything. I'm going to break it down. And then I was kind of really bummed out from not being able to sing. And so I got really, what we call in the West Country, sided up. You get soldered up.
Is that like pissed?
Yes, it is. Okay, yes, okay. You're fluent in English.
Well, I was going to ask
English,
you how
English.
You rehabbed your nodes, but maybe you went a completely different direction.
Well, you know what? This kind of played into it, so I did get soldered up, a.k.a. pissed, on cider. And I started doing cartwheels on wet grass. I'm glad there's one laugh. because I just traveled. I did like a handspring where you just go over and over, and I went over and over. And then on the third over, I was just surfing, and I was like, oh dear, I'm going to have to choose a leg to break.
Were you looking for something other than music to do?
Or yeah, at this point, I can't do it. Yeah, I was at this point, I had nothing. I was just like tumbleweed.
Right.
Oh. You know, for me, probably tumble fro. If you have fro hair, you always leave little bubbles everywhere. You'll see them. They'll be everywhere, just twisting out the ends. Oh, tumble fro. So there was some... There's going to be an eternity of black jokes up in this situation, okay? Like, luckily, I broke my leg. So one...
Luckily...
Because then I really was, like, if I was any kind of disability kind of dispute, then I was like, yeah, and I also can't walk, so. And they're like, okay, you're on. I'm like, I'm going to be able to eat. So that was great.
Yeah.
And I had loads of tramadol, which is just like level below morphine for the old opiates. But luckily I don't have the addictive personality and addictive gene,
right.
That, which is lucky because that stuff's too good. And
may have heard we have a bit of an opioid issue.
Yeah, a slight opioid issue. I am super lucky that the genes didn't play that game with me.
Wow.
It's sugar. Yeah. Which is that's just the whole black thing again, just the BTs. That's cake, that's my problem.
Yeah.
I just do lines of cake. Just like, give me cakes, Victoria Sponge, just lines of Victoria Sponge any day of the week, mate. I'll have it, frickin' English breakfast tea chaser.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, the upside was that I was so high that I couldn't be as so I was talking about how stress affects the vocal cords. It's very hard to be stressed on that much tramadol, and so between that and obviously the rest, and I got speech therapy, but then speech therapy didn't really know about singing, so then I had to develop. I started stalking all these specialists in voice osteopathy, in vocal biomechanics, in respiratory physiotherapy.
I mean, prior to all that, were
and
you
this
somebody,
is all my downtime.
Did you take a lot of lessons? Did you have like technique and craft and all
I
that
had,
with your thing?
I went to an opera school for maybe 6 months.
Right.
That was just weekly lessons where I was just like, am I doing things safely?
Right.
Going through my range, going through different kind of music that I was in and different environments, making sure that I was safe. And like a little bit of stylistic, but it was all very much styled towards opera.
So did you have to reinvent how you sang?
No, because I didn't start in opera. I kind of, that was very much like end of high school kind of age.
Right.
I was just kind of seeing whether I had that within my kind of wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And so I was just interested in it. It was more of a study the style more than anything else. But I picked up a little bit of technical knowledge from that.
Right.
But most of it was in this period. So I was just studying everything. And by the time I finished, I ended up kind of writing a little course for myself. And my voice started getting stronger and until it was back. And then it was stronger than before I lost it. And then I was like, oh, how have I done that? And so I carried on doing that, and then friends started asking me questions. Then university started asking me questions. Then I became a lecturer on the subject of vocal biomechanics.
Oh, really?
And I ended up doing that until Massive Attack called me and were like, do you want to, we need a super sub on the old vocals.
Right.
And so the same controlling person that I was dealing with, like, with, you know, another one of the kind of, like, it wasn't a white bureaucracy in that situation, but it was definitely bro, like, you know, right. It's a bro environment, but, like, and they also were really looking to, like, get something new from Bristol,
right.
And so that's what kind of ignited me at that time.
But that's also very different musically
very
than what we know you
exactly
for.
So I was like, this is exciting because they're looking for something new from Bristol, but it's also absolutely nothing to do with me. And so I was like, do you know what, it'll be interesting part of my life. And they're musically iconic as heck. And
sure.
So I just knew that I'd be something I could do, something inspirational that I could do for myself. We did a little bit of writing, but in the end, I just decided I need to keep on my path right. of what I've been trying to do. Went back to the band, carried on doing top lining on the side, and kind of saw that right through until I was like, you know what, this environment hasn't been working for me in so many ways. Like, I've been gradually building up the top lining game that I was, as everyone's kind of reputations were building. But, you know, this kind of band thing, I was learning a lot about the kind of top liner I wanted to be. But, like, there are clearly kind of shackles on the rest of what I could do.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, I just need to be somewhere else. I am done. This environment, the entire paradigm of brotocracy, Broville, I need to be out of here. And so I just kind of cut fast. And I cut with 1 degree of separation because there are people that whose minds were like controlled by that paradigm. And they're as helpless, you know? Like, you're trying to explain what you're trying to do, and there's no one that they know, and their friends are useless. And everyone is, like, just an avenue back to the same problem you have. Mm. So I cut with 1 degree of separation,
right.
And I was like, I am starting from scratch. I think 5 people survived. And I was like, right, I need to rehash my networks. I need to get a solid idea of what I'm doing. I have nothing. the control machine started kind of, I was useful to a number of people, so I had to move house and change my phone number.
Mm.
Like, it was unreal, the kind of...
You made a real break.
The break was right. real, and then I just took a hiatus from music for 3 years. I did a few songs, writing-wise. I just kind of kept that bubbling along at a very low level.
Yeah, yeah.
But fortunately, one of them got into the top 10.
Really?
Yeah.
What was that?
I did a little kind of EDM pop crossover song, with a guy called Subfocus, and it's like just a dancey thing. And like
when you do
at
that,
the time,
does it have your name attached to it?
Oh,
is it
no.
like the artist featuring Yola?
No. Right. I'd call it a featured non-feature.
Right. I mean, that's interesting to have a song that's a hit and like, and you don't wind up getting any sort of.
No, that was on purpose.
Right?
That was by design.
Okay.
I was like, when I debut, it's going to look like I came out of nowhere.
Right.
On purpose.
Right.
Because I want the opportunity to write my own story.
Right.
I don't want it to be written for me. And if there's one thing, certainly that happens for black women, like the second you do something, if I was a white guy, I could just go into hip hop from, you know, I could just basically do a Beck basically and go around the genres all day, every day. Mm. But I have to say the word eclectic in every interview. I have to ungenre myself everywhere I go. Because I think
genre hopping for anybody, even in the white world,
yeah,
I think can
really
be kind of
hard.
The kiss of death, you know, for a lot of people. You know?
Yeah, it can be really hard.
Yeah.
It's not the easiest thing to do. But if your brand generally is a mix,
right,
then
right.
that's more than hopping.
Right,
you know,
right, right.
Genre hopping is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, it takes
and
like
so,
a Bowie or somebody like that.
Yeah,
that really
exactly,
can do
and
it,
it's really know? Hard.
Yeah.
It, you're right,
yeah.
And it's and so I knew that was one thing that I had to just like. You know, if I wasn't pursuing it, as a main artist thing, which I wasn't. I was like, I'm just writing. It's just sometimes they're looking for a vocalist and the only vocalist they can think of is me. And so...
You were too damn good and in the band.
And I refused to be in the band. And so it was always like, no, I've got a mission and I can't do that. Yeah. So genre hopping, you're right. It's a whole thing. So I purposefully didn't feature on a bunch of stuff to give myself the opportunity for doing what I really want to do when I get into the environment that's right, that's healthy, that's conducive to me making the sound that I wanted to make, that was about me and it wasn't about serving the brief, you know?
Yeah.
And so this got to number 10 and then I did a vocal again, featured, non-feature, a bit of where I was in the production team, so we're doing like the vocal stacks and all this kind of stuff. And I always worked as like in the production teams as part of the vocal team, guiding a singer through something, or like biomechanically, or doing like writing backing parts. Like I did like a Christmas thing for Katy Perry, and all the stacks were kind of arrangements that I did this stuff. But in this case, it was just like a few stacks and the top line that I sang, but I didn't write. But on the neighboring rights alone, I was golden because it got to number 2 in the UK and the US. It was Duke Dumont, a song called Won't Look Back. And between that and the top 10 that I had, I was like, okay, I've got a choice. I've now got enough money to either build something, start building something of a solo career, or I could just buy a house and give up on music altogether. And because it's going to be it's going to take the even amount of money of investment. Yeah. And so I wrote a business plan for myself and started acting on it. And
you are so much more organized than like 99% of all musicians. I don't know anybody that ever wrote a business plan for their career. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, that was everything that I had. And so if I was going to spend everything I have, I better have a plan for it.
Well, so in all that, how did you and Dan Auerbach wind up finding each other?
Oh, tea's gone. It's all right. I'll survive.
Do we need a towel?
We might need a towel
up here.
I've only got one splash. I've
emergency
nailed it so far.
Emergency towel situation.
I know. Drippy cup. What are you going to do? Fools. We'll get it later.
That's a cheap trick your manager played on you.
I know. No, it's all right. It's a slightly drippy situation now. I'll survive.
So how did you and Dan Auerbach
find
each other?
So part of this kind of investment run was I knew I was going to need to come to Nashville. Yeah, you can come up, Bubba. Thank you. Cheers. I know. Oh, that'll do. Oh, drippy cups are evil, aren't they? Part of my plan, I'd come to... So in my band, we'd done a record in LA with Mark Ford, previously of the Black Keys. Not Black Keys, what are we talking
Black
about?
Crows.
I'm thinking about Dad. Yeah, yeah, Black Crows. Ah, close with no cigar. And I was... and then we wrote up, me and my co-writer wrote ourselves back across America. Our publisher set up some rights and we came through Nashville.
Okay.
And I noticed, like in LA, everything was so spread out and the opportunity for serendipity was super down there. It was because everyone's driving and then all the parties, it's a rooftop thing and it's invite only. And like it's all like just so sectioned off. That whole, I'm going to bump into somebody halfway down the road or at the end of Music Row at that sandwich place or at that cafe that everyone goes to because it's the one near the office is like all of that wasn't happening. And then we got to Nashville and this was 2010, so it's before all of this happened, the beginning of all the explosion of Nashville.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, people would go to the same place for lunch if they weren't getting lunch delivered to the office, you know. And so conversations would be happening, all of this serendipity of people going and talking during the lunch hour. Oh, have you seen so-and-so from so-and-so? Yeah, who have they got in? Oh, this person. And then they go back and talk to someone in the New York office or whatever. Oh, how's your day going? Yeah, yeah. Who have you got in so-and-so from so-and-so? Oh, what cities are they going through? Oh, blah, blah. And it was just that bump in. It meant that your name would go around a number of companies. And I noticed at that point that it was important that to be here because it was small enough for people to have these serendipitous moments of bumping in, having conversations, wherever, they're picking their kids up from after school club, the like after the second session of the afternoon, that kind of regimented 10 to 1, lunch 2 to 5 type thing. All of that kind of made for those serendipitous moments. And so we didn't get half the rights we were looking for in LA. And we came to Nashville and we just got a bunch. And that made the New York leg, as we were writing our way back to England, even more kind of populated. And we were trying to set it all up before and then was like, yeah, whatevs. But just from being in Nashville and people talking, just everything changed. And I was like, that's because you've got so many houses close to each other, like with at least a room dedicated to a company.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm always blown away at how willing to write with people.
Yes.
All the writers are here, you know?
Like, yes.
It's kind of amazing.
It's so different for that reason. It's so special for that reason. And I noticed that in 2010. So in 2016, when I was like, okay, I'm spending all my money on this, I was like, I'm definitely going to Nashville. You've like, obviously. And so I come here for my first Americana Fest. And I'd done the Americana UK event. And if you kind of did well in that, they'll bring out a contingent of Brits to here. And so I came up with the contingent of Brits. And that's where, with the help of my still publicist, Doug Hall, just spreading my name around, and it did a good old circuit of Nashville. NPR were very kind, and Powers was very kind in tipping me early doors. And so I got a little bit of like all of this kind of first round of PR, which went pretty good. It was a pretty good year.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of meetings with a bunch of people, all of which I was like, you all gross me out.
Did you say that in the meeting?
Yeah, I was just like, I was getting into a situation where it was just loads of what we call Johnny Giant Balls, you know?
Do tell, I've never heard that term.
Johnny Giant Balls is the, okay, so. Oh, you weren't expecting this, were you, babes? I'm sorry. Oh, so Johnny Giant Balls is the guy that invites you into his office, and he sits on a perfectly acceptable chair behind a desk, and then he gives you a little clown chair. or he gives you a very nice chair, but it's like, it's not the same chair.
Right.
Like, we're having a conversation, yeah. So we're on the same right. level, right. same chair.
Yeah.
Like, if I was on a yoga ball or something, I'd be like, what are you trying to do to
right,
me?
Right, right, right. You know, now that you mention it, I think I have encountered Johnny Giant Balls
yeah.
a time or two in this business. I remember that now.
Yes. Yes, all musicians at some point, especially if you're talking to the bigwigs, may have seen Johnny and his giant balls. And and so they put you on the kind of like the reclining chair, so you just can't get comfortable. And so there you are, and you're kind of, your legs are kimbo, your guts hanging out. Mm. Like, it's all, you know, nothing's right, you know. I'm really trying it. And then they sit from their throne upon high and just disseminate how amazing they are. And you're like, thank you, sir, bow and curtsy. No, if you would only consider. A hunchback and ruddy well Notre Dame. It's a ruddy joke, mate. Anywho, and I'm just like, so what I was doing, I was getting into the offices here, and if they had the mistake of having one and an arm on it, I just drag it to the edge of the table, the same distance they were away, turn the arm around and sit on the arm at exactly the same level, or just rearrange it. I come in and I go, this won't do, love. And I rearrange the room until I could experience it in an adult way. And so 2016 was like just going through various Johnnies and their humongoid junk and just dealing with their superiority complex. And once I got through that and I experienced people walking into a room and going, oh, so you have an afro and flares and you sing country-influenced music. Okay, I get it. I'm like, wow, so I haven't even started talking yet. Mm. And like the kind of, you know, black reductiveness was pretty massive. And so once I got over that hump, I was like, okay, round two, I don't know when I do this, I'm going to be really selective over who I meet. I'm going to make sure that when I look him in the eye, they're looking at me like I'm looking at you now. Right. With just the, we're engaging, connections happening on a human level. This is nice. This is all I wanted. But like I said, this is literally, yeah. It's not that hard.
Right.
This is literally all I wanted. Anyway, people struggle at exactly this.
Generally not the dynamic in this business.
And so 2017 came round, I did Americana Fest again. And I had meetings with people, and it was all very, a lot more meaningful. I met my manager, who very kindly delivered this to me. And we'd met before, we'd been talking for about a year, and we kind of were sealing the deal at that time. My name did a bigger circle, thanks again to good old Doug, a bigger circle, and it bumped into Dan's people, or a friend of Dan's, and British Underground, were talking to this lovely Aussie fellow, and he was really tight with Dan, and they were, so through those channels of connection, we're like, people are like, we think you need to hear this. And so Charlie, my manager, takes a video, and sends it on through these channels, and he sees the video and was like, so can we get her in now? How about now? And then they were like, we'll have a look at your diary. And the next available spot was a couple months later. And so I went back to England, and then I flew back in 2 months, and we started writing, I think we wrote Shady Grove.
Oh, so yeah. You and Dan write together?
Yeah. And he'd always like have some surprise third guest of fabulosity. He'd be like Bobby Woods or Dan Penn or legend of the highest order.
I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you about writing with Dan Penn in particular. Mm. But for people who aren't familiar, who don't know who Dan Penn is, who is Dan Penn?
You may be acquainted with the songs Do Right Woman or Dark End of the Street. Little known songs like that.
Memphis legend.
Yes, yeah. And a stone cold Memphis legend. And the walking, talking crossover of country and soul.
Right.
You know, if I know the number of times that people go, so country soul, like oh, that's a interesting mix. I'm like, no, it's not. Dan Penn exists.
Right. I mean, what's that like in a room writing with a guy like that who you know, of course, I'm sure it's just a gigantic fan of his work.
Yes.
I mean, do you ever get like, can you get comfortable going like, no, I don't like your idea?
Well, no, not really.
Do you have those moments?
It's like he's so legitimate. You're just like, even if you don't understand it, it's probably right. Right. No, I was talking about, we started by just having a conversation. He goes, tell me a little bit about yourself. And so I was like, well, we've done a few writing sessions by this time. And, excuse me, this is going to happen. Tea. and I was like, well, do you know what? I was in a house fire somewhat recently, and I was kind of a human torch. And as I was burning, I found myself laughing my merry ass off. And he's like, what? And I'm like, well, you know, I had to think of something worse than being on fire to break myself out of what they call static shock. Mm. Like you either run around like a headless chicken, you know, the fight or flight thing. I was just like.
You were literally on fire.
Yeah, it was Christmas time in the middle of my 3-year hiatus from music. Back second, third. And I was wrapping presents and I was testing a bioethanol burner, which is like a table centerpiece, like a candle. Like, you know, you have those candle arrangements. It's like a arrangement that you have a little bit of bioethanol in that soaks a wick or like just in a reservoir, and it has that little pretty flame, gives off a tiny bit of heat, and you know, it's a cute thing for a table. Anyway,
until it burns your house down.
Yeah, until it sets you on fire. It worked perfectly fine, but the little canister of bioethanol that had one of those, you know, screw tops, and it just wasn't quite adhering the way that you would like. It wasn't quite closing to. So you'd pour it, and there'd be a very invisible little drip happening. You know what alcohol's like? When it hits a surface, it disappears. It's not, you don't see it as liquid because it evaporates. Mostly, not completely, sadly. So, when I lit it, I was like, oh, this looks nice. And then a little trickle came out of the reservoir, clearly where it's just been dripping as I've been taking it up to it, and caught the canister. And the canister goes,
oh, Jesus.
And then another little trickle, clearly from where I've just been holding it, goes up my dress, up my hands, and I'm my dress goes up, and so at this point I'm burning, and I'm like obviously in shock because it's accelerant, so it happens very quickly.
And the songwriter in you is like, oh, this is gonna be great.
Yes!
I got so much fuel
this
here.
Is gonna be so good. Dan Penn and Dan Auerbach are still sitting here at this point listening to exactly what I'm telling you right now. So you are Dan Penn right now. And I'm like, and so I have to think of something worse, because obviously the speed of it, you just go into shock. It's like involuntary. And I thought of the first 30 years of my life. And I've told you a little bit about it. I've not gone into any of the detail because it's just truly so harrowing. I'm not getting into it. I don't deserve to put myself through that again. And you can ask and ask till the cows come home. Not today. Maybe not ever. I'll decide if. And I thought back to that time and I was like, I'd take my life now, plus fire, any day of the week. And I just started laughing. I was laughing so hard. I was like, oh yeah, stop, drop and roll. So I stopped, dropped and rolled.
Oh yeah, put myself out.
Yeah, but I was like, I wasn't static anymore because I was laughing, and like obviously the chemicals you get from laughing are the antithesis of cortisol, which is very helpful. So there I am, rolling and rolling, snuffing and snuffing and snuffing, and I'm no longer burning, which is great. And I'm like, right, okay, but here still is, and I'd like to ideally live here. So I go outside, get a hose, come back in, and I put the fire out myself. And my neighbor comes and helps lean on the door to help with the backdraft. And so we're just like putting it out for probably about half an hour, 45 minutes. And then the fire brigade turn up, and they're like, oh, you've done it. I'm like, yeah. I'm feeling pretty triumphant, to be honest, babes. And like, so, like, yeah, I'm just there, like, you know, just grinning from ear to ear, going, life's really good. I'm loved. It's great. And I, you know, like, to go into the smallest part of it, I kind of throwaway commented living on the streets, but I did. And in that time of my life, with all of my friends that we've now discovered were douchebags, I had just a situation where I needed to live. I need to move out of the house that I was in, and I need somewhere to stay. And everyone was like, oh, I'm sorry, it's not convenient. Oh, I'm sorry. I like, you know, I've got like a cat. Oh, like, like it was the whole kind of thing. So, and like, it was just everyone, same kind of, I don't give a crap whether you live or die crew. And so I ended up living in a big kind of hold-all kind of gym bag in a bush, sleeping zipped up in a bush in East London for a few days, and then begging, trying to get money and to be able to call someone to come fetch me to Bristol, where I grew up, and I knew I at least had one friend who wasn't a douchebag. And only one, though. and that friend did come and get me, as I thought they would. And yeah, like, I realized at post-burning and looking at, I can't live here for at least a few months until they remodel it, that I had too many places. I had too many places. I had too many people that gave a crap. And people that I'd known for a long time that had been pushed away because they weren't in the mental paradigm I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
People who I'd newly connected with, everything in between. Just people that were just full of love and were not mentally compromised by that weird world that governs so much of music. And like, I was just like, I'm totally cool. I feel like I could just go to my mate's house and like, you're probably burned. You probably need to go to intensive care. I think you need to go to ICU. And so I went to ICU and lo and behold, I was burned. And so I just got wrapped up like a mummy, given loads of gas and air. I was laughing my ass off the whole time, just with my mate and who came with me. And yeah, I'm just like, I was just full of joy. And so I was talking to Dan Penn and Dan Aga back about this, and they were like, let's write a song about this. And that's where Walk Through Fire came from.
Mm. Yeah. And do you bring in songs? Like, did you bring songs to those sessions that were pretty fully formed, and then you guys tinkered with them and changed them up?
Well,
or were you just like creating new songs in the studio?
Both.
Right.
And so mostly the latter.
Right.
Just trying to react to what it would sound like if all three people were in the room,
right,
instead of necessarily trying to impose someone's will in one direction. It was like, but what does it sound like if all three mix evenly?
Right.
Which is a wonderful thing you can get from writing, is that kind of the commonplace looked at from three different angles.
Yeah.
But
it's the beauty of collaboration.
It
really
is. Yeah. It is at its best. It gets things. It sees things from angles that you can't see from, and which is why it's so important to write with different people all the time.
You know, I hate to do a hard left turn here, but I'm getting the wrap it up sign.
Yeah.
From my people over there, and
well,
I have one last question that I wanted to ask
it's
you
all
about.
It's all good. I wrote one on my own. That was it. It ain't easier. I brought that in, and that was pretty much as is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was just me.
Well, okay. So I've been over to the UK a bunch in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to, you know, since we're talking about traumatic events that that influence your art, it seems to me over in the UK, and like, you know, obviously we have our own traumatic political world happening here right now, but you guys have your own with Brexit. And the thing that the feeling that I get over there with my friends that live in the UK is this uncertainty and stress of what the fuck is going to happen. How is this going to play out? I mean, how is that affecting you as a, you know, as a person, or just as, is that,
oh,
is that influencing your writing now?
Well, the thing is that I'm never home.
There you go.
So in a weird way, because I'm never there, like I've got a very maybe muted experience comparatively to people that will come to Americana Fest or come to a tour and then go home and be home. I'm actually letting go of the apartment. I've been in that same apartment that I had the fire in. I still technically live in.
Okay.
But I will not be living there because I've not, I would have been in it for 10 of the 12 months I'm paying for it. No, I would have not been in it for 10 of the 12 months.
Right.
And so I'm just not in the UK. And so I've got a kind of maybe a muted experience of everything.
Right.
I'm fully aware of the fact that things are supposed to be happening on the 31st, and I'm supposed to be doing a European tour on the 1st of November. And so that's going to be an interesting little hippity hop over.
Sure.
I'm very fortunately looked after by WME, who are not by any means a small company.
No.
And one is hoping that their humongous machine has managed to negotiate some sort of plan.
As a contingency plan there.
As a contingency for a giant multinational. Yeah, let's hope.
It's gonna be a new world, I guess.
It's gonna be
for touring.
It's just a hot mess is the truth. It's a hot, hot mess. Absolutely galloping douchebags, left, right, back and center. like sociopaths.
I think
of
we
the
just came up
order.
With a name for your tour.
I know. Gallop. The Enduring of Galloping Douchebags Tour.
On that note, we have to end it. You have been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Give it up for Yola.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, that was Yola on Walking the Floor. How cool was that? She was awesome, and the crowd was awesome. I like doing these live Walking the Floor tapings. I hope we do a whole bunch more. I managed to do a few of them while I was out there at Americana Fest, so a couple more coming up in that style. It's different when you're in front of people. I don't know. It's a different deal. The one thing is, it's actually kind of hard to hear the person you're interviewing, I noticed. It's hard to, it's a different, it's a, how, what am I trying to say? It's a strange way to have a conversation with somebody when you're sitting there in front of a room full of people, but it's super fun and I dig it. All right, so that's it for this week. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. I don't know which one. I got a lot to choose from. Could be Robert Earl Keane. Could be Jack Ingram. Could be Randy Houser. Could be Tony Brown. Could be Kendall Marvel. I don't know. I'm not going to make that decision just yet. I'm going to leave you hanging. Okay, adios, amigos.